That's the ethereal, eerie guitar work of the great Robin Trower from 1974's Bridge of Sighs album. The song is called In This Place. We're talking with Dave Politis, who will be here for the rest of this hour. In hour four, we'll be joined by Ben Politis, who has directed a film version, of sort of the movie version of the Missing 411 books. In this hour, we're going to get into a case that it knocked my socks off when I read it, and it's one that it reminds me of some of the material that we encountered and investigated at Skinwalker Ranch. So that should tell you how strange it gets. And it involves the family of a name that would be very well known to listeners of this program. And if that's not enough of a tease, I don't know what is. We'll be right back and jump into it in a couple of minutes here. Stay with us here on Coast to Coast AM. So, Dave, before the break, we were talking a couple of topics that I want to return to. One was about, the level of cooperation you get from the National Park Service, and I would think you'd want to keep those channels open. The other was about advice for people who are going out into the woods, especially into some of these places that are known as clusters for these vanishings or disappearances. And the one particular piece of equipment I was concerned about was cell phones. Do they help at all, or does it matter at all?
It's surprising how many areas in the woods where you wouldn't think you'd have cell reception, but you do. And that cell phone can be used for a lot of different things that it may not be readily come to your mind when you're out there in the woods, but I have a flashlight tool on mine and some
Sure.
other things that could be useful while you're in the woods. Always, always take it. But in a lot of the cases I write about, the people are somehow separated from the phone, which is kind of strange. But absolutely, always carry your cell phone with you. One of the things that we talked about before was cooperation. And one of the things I like to think that I pride myself in is being able to get along with different people from different venues. And that's why I think I got that National Park special agent retired to talk to me. And I'm this guy who lives in the world of facts. I don't come up with these wild hypotheses. I don't make a lot of radical judgments. Like I said about search and rescue people, they're all great people. This is not it's not an indictment of them in any way. And the same with the National Park Service. The people you know and that you see at the national parks, they're some of the best people in the world. And they're not the ones making these decisions, and they're not the ones that have the visibility on the issues. In the movie, we actually interviewed the former head of the Department of the Interior. And I won't say what happens there, but it's pretty enlightening what happens. And I just want to say that those people from the national parks, hey, when you're in trouble, they're going to be the first ones out there looking for you. And they're going to risk their life to try to save you. And without them, we would be in a world of hurt. So don't think that this is an indictment of all of the national parks people or all of the search and rescue people. It's far from it. It's an extremely lopsided thing. 99.99% salt of the earth, great, great people, and we're lucky to have them.
Yeah, I was thinking that, the ones that I've dealt with, I mean, they're in that job because they love the land. They love the parks. They like to protect it and take care of it and the people who visit there. So, yeah, my experience has been pretty positive. But of course, I haven't traveled the same road that you had or tried to accomplish the same thing to such intensity. I want to ask about this case that I've been alluding to for a while now. Man, it just came out of the blue as I'm reading this book, and it was like a punch to the gut. It is, and it really does remind me of Skinwalker Ranch, which we can get into after you tell the story. Go ahead.
Well, I should premise this that in all of my books, you won't read about a story like this. And over the years, I've had dozens and dozens of stories come to me from people about weird things that happened to them out in the woods, out on the trail. One of these things, like I just said, I kind of live in this world of facts. Well, there's a series of facts associated with this story that confirms something really weird happened, and that's why I wrote about it. Otherwise, I would just discount it, say, and not call a person a liar, obviously, but I couldn't prove it, so I would ignore it. Now, in this one, it was forwarded to me by several people, and I said, okay, I need to look at this. And when I started to look into it, right away because of who was involved, and I knew the person, and I've gone to them in the past for technical information and reiteration of facts and expertise. The person is beyond reproach as the most credible person you could ever come across. And I don't know if you've had the same feelings, but
oh, yeah.
You know that.
I know him. I know him well, and I agree with your assessment completely.
So anyhow, what happened was is that there was a story out there, and this person had documented it and wrote about it. So I called this person, and I said, hey, this is an amazing story. I'd like to kind of bring it into my world and see how much I can back up and see is what's credible. And obviously you thought the reporting person was credible, but I'd like to interview him. And he kind of giggles. He goes, it was my wife. I says, oh my God. I says, well, could I interview her? He goes, absolutely. So I was given access, and nobody knew about this until it came out in the book who this person really was. But kind of the background on it was this woman was a bow hunter. And this is the part of the story that immediately caught my attention because, as I told you earlier, it seems like an abnormal number of bow hunters disappear. So they were in an area kind of in central United States, fairly near the Great Lakes area. And that's another thing that caught my attention because I've talked openly on your show that there's a lot of disappearances that ring the Great Lakes all the way around it. And I can't make out why it's happening, but it does. So anyhow, she goes into this deer stand and kind of an area near her house where she's gone many times. And her deer seat is about 15 feet up in the air, wooded acreage, about a mile from a high school. Now, if she was using a firearm, she wouldn't be there, but she's bow hunting. So, and she was in the seat at about 5:30 in the afternoon, late afternoon. Well, at 6:21, she starts taking some photos with her BlackBerry. And as she's sitting there, she says, all of a sudden, the woods go completely silent. She said, it caught my attention right away. Everything stops. Well, now what's weird about that is I've talked on your show and Nori's show that I've been hunting before, and the exact same thing happened to me. And the hunter I was with was 70 years old. He said, Dave, that's never happened to me before. Let's sit down, and you take one side of the tree, I'll take the other, and we're going to sit here until the sound comes back. Something weird is going on. Well, she knew it was weird, and she said, I held my phone up, and I was texting some friends. And I had my phone in one hand, and I'm looking across from me, kind of across this trail that she was on, and she's looking at trees 15 to 20 feet in front of her. And she says she couldn't believe what she was looking at. She goes, she thought she had something in her eye at the beginning. But then she said it reminded her of looking at something that was wrapped in saran wrap, meaning that you could kind of see through it, but it was almost distorted. But there was a distinct figure there, but it was distorted. And she first noticed it in a tree across from her. And she goes, now I'm holding the BlackBerry in one hand, and I'm so fixated on this object and so scared she didn't know what to think until she sees the object jump from one tree to another tree. Not any closer to her, but keeping that 15 to 25 foot distance. Well, it was 6:20, 6:23 at about that time. And she says she's scared out of her mind, but she's not going to leave the blind. And it slowly moves out of her view and disappears. And she goes, now she has to think about what she's going to do. She's in this blind. She's got her bow and arrow. Sound eventually comes back, but there's no deer, there's no animals, there's nothing. So she goes, okay, so I waited out about 90 minutes, and I get out of there, and I go straight back to the car and her home. Well, she gets in the house, and they were having friends for dinner. And she doesn't know how to really approach what just happened. And she decides to just kind of keep it to herself until dishes are done. And she checks her computer, and she has a message from her nephew, who's in the band, marching band, at the high school that's a mile away from her hunting blind. And in the message, she says that her nephew, and she brings her husband over to see this, And the nephew explains that the entire band sees this bright object in the sky right above them on their, as they're on the field. And it moves kind of sideways, and it circles around, and it starts out large, and it gets continually smaller until it disappears. And then 5 minutes later, the same object appears, and it does the same thing. And this was going on between 7:50 that night and 8 o'clock. Well, later on that night, the people leave, and she starts talking to her husband about what happened. And she goes, you know, I had the phone in my hand, but I don't know what happened. I might have taken a picture. I might have not. And the husband looks at the phone and goes, yeah, you took a picture at 6:23. And he goes, boy, this is a weird-looking picture. And when you look at the picture, I'd say 90% of the photo is blurry. But then right in the middle, kind of on the left side, there's like a long piece of hair that's curly. But there's many pieces to that one curly segment. And her husband goes, that's the weirdest thing I've ever seen. And so he's one of the smartest guys you'll ever meet in your life. And he starts going through the BlackBerry, looking at the pixelization. And the next day they call Verizon and they send him the picture and they go, tell us how this happened. And they go, well, technically, it's impossible for that camera to take that picture. And he goes, what do you mean? He goes, based on the size of the pixelization, that camera can't take that picture. But because of the numbering on the photo and the timing, we can guarantee that the camera did take the picture, but it's impossible it did take the picture. And the husband says, well, that is really strange. And they go into this big talk and about what she saw, and he's listening, and he goes, well, that sounds like this movie that I saw. And he puts on the movie Predator. And he goes, they fast forward to the segment. And he goes, tell me if that's what you saw. And she goes, oh, my God, that is exactly the type of distortion I saw in that tree. Well, now, what really catches me about this is, first of all, the photo. The timing of the photo, the impossibility of the photo, and who's involved in looking and deciphering the specific facts behind the photo. People go missing in the late afternoon or the early evening. Bull hunters go missing more than others. The timing of the incident with the anomaly and the incident in the air above the band members and the proximity to the Great Lakes and the cluster zones in that area, I said, you know what? I've never done this before. I'm going to put it in the book. I'm going to put it in the book because there's too many facts to support this incident really happened.
Let's give the name.
Well, the name's in the book. I mean, I've said that. Yeah. I don't know how many thousands of people are going to read it, but the man was Bruce Maccabee, and he's an optical physicist. And if there was anybody in the world that would be able to take that camera apart and the BlackBerry apart to understand why it did what it did, it would have been Bruce. And the weird thing was that this happened to somebody in his family, it's unbelievable.
Dr. Bruce Maccabee, well-renowned, well-regarded optical physicist who has done a lot of photo analysis in the UFO world. He's given briefings to CIA. He's well-regarded by pretty much everybody who knows him. So his credibility is pretty good. He writes about this, but doesn't identify that the person who had the experience is his wife. It's interesting that, as I alluded to a little bit ago, it was an almost identical kind of experience on the Skinwalker Ranch, that ranch in Utah that Colm Kelleher and I had written about. I think the incident happened in 1995, where the rancher and his son and a visitor to the property saw what they later described as just exactly like the thing in the Predator movie, moving through the bushes. It comes out of the bushes as if it's sort of some kind of technical camouflage, and it has this encounter and scares the heck out of this visitor who was on the property. And it made me think of that immediately, like maybe there is technology involved in this, that it, whatever is out there, is using technology to camouflage itself as part of a predatory activity involving humans. And you come pretty close to almost saying that in the book, and I know you don't like to pin yourself down, but I mean, you have the chapters called The Predator Story.
Well, I think that the one thing that kind of throws this into the really weird zone is the photo she takes of this kind of hair in this blurry background. And Bruce went through an exhaustive analysis of how that couldn't have been a picture of, her name is Jan, of Jan or her hair. It had to have been taken straight forward based on a lot of things with the sun and the angles, and he's way smarter than me, so I couldn't even explain it adequately, but it had to have been taken at the object that she was facing. And why would this object appear to have some kind of hair on it that is, it's pretty obvious in the photo that's what it is.
Now you look at the big picture, Dave, and I know, again, you don't like to say what it is or what it isn't, but the big picture is it's been going on a long time. It's over a wide area. It's not just one person or one thing doing it. It's got to be something that gets around. It acts like a predator. Some people get essentially they get abducted. Sometimes the bodies are found. Sometimes the bodies are not found. A lot of times there's nothing found. It acts like it's culling a herd. It takes weak and feeble, sick, young, old people who can be plucked. It acts with impunity. It's not intimidated by weapons. It's like a harvesting of some sort. I mean, I don't know how else you describe it.
Well, you know, going back to the ranch scenario, one of the things when I read that book, and, you know, it's an outdoor environment. There isn't a lot of big population zones around where the ranch was. And one of the things in all of my research, I always kept my eyes open about that part of the country for missing people. And there really weren't a lot of missing people around the ranch. In fact, in the book I just read, there was only a couple of people in that Utah area that went missing that I wrote about that were pretty unusual. But that specific area, there was almost nothing.
Well, I have to agree with that assessment. And then the ranch itself, although a lot of really strange stuff, a lot of violent stuff happened, it wasn't to humans. It was to animals. It was a lot of mental torture and psychological effects, but no humans were ever hurt. You're right. I don't know of any kind of vanishings or disappearances in the 20 years that we've been working on that.
Yeah, one of the things I always get asked at conferences is, well, what kind of, you know, because I've told you already in this show that I get a lot of strange stories told to me by hunters and outdoorsmen, et cetera, but I haven't written about them, again, because there's not this trail of evidence like there is in this incident. But one of the stories that was told to me a couple years ago by an elk hunter in Colorado, northern Colorado, he was hunting just above tree line, really high. He was alone. And he feels this rumbling in the ground, and he thought, well, maybe there's a herd of elk coming at me, so I better start paying attention. He turns and kind of levels his rifle out it towards this meadow area that's coming up over this mound at him. And he was in thick grass, and he said that he saw the grass separating and kind of going from left to right at an equidistance from him, say maybe 50, 150 feet or so. He said he could see the grass separating. He could feel the earth moving, but he couldn't see anything. And he says it was almost as though you took a snowplow and you plowed an area in front of it from left to right until you lost sight of it and it stopped rumbling and it disappeared. He says it was the weirdest thing he ever saw. He's never seen it again. And he says, I won't go back to that area. And I left the mountain after that. But he goes, I couldn't even tell you what happened.
We're going to take a break here. Tom Petty, Shadow People, takes us into the break. When we come back, I'll open up the phone lines with a couple of your quick, direct questions for Dave. And then I want to ask him about the few people who've returned who have some recollection of what happened to them. They tell some unusual stories about what happens to their minds during these incidents. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with David Politis about his new book, Missing 411, Hunters, Unexplained Disappearances, and it does not disappoint. As we just mentioned, we just heard this incredible story that was first told by Dr. Bruce Maccabee, an optical physicist. What he didn't make public is that the incident happened to his wife, who was out bow hunting in a wooded area not too far from their home. She encounters this thing that's sort of like from the movie Predator, same kind of sort of a camellia type creature in the trees, similar to what had been seen on the Skinwalker Ranch years before. She fires off a photo that, according to the company that controls the cell phone account, she shouldn't have been able to do, not technically anyway. And then a couple of minutes later, nearby, some multiple witnesses at a high school see what appears to be a UFO. Quite a coincidence. I should mention that the photo that was taken by Mrs. Maccabee is in the book, and you'll have to see it yourself and figure out what the heck that means. We'll take a couple of your calls for my guest, Dave Politis. So a lot of folks will be on the lines. Please be courteous to your fellow Coast to Coast listeners and get right to the point. We'll be right back. A quick mention that if you're going to buy the book, Missing 411, Amazon is not the place to look for it. You should go to the link that we provided on the Coast to Coast website, canammissing.com. And I guess there's a lot of folks who have complained to us before. They see Dave's books that are being sold online for $65 or $70, and it's not him that's doing it. It's other folks, right, David?
That's correct.
I want to ask one more question, then we'll go to the phones. You know, you have a couple of cases where people survive these strange encounters. They come back. Their memories are kind of foggy about what happened to them. Or you have cases where witnesses get glimpses of what happens to their friends, their fellow hunters. And it's like, it's almost like they're not under their own control, that there's some kind of mind control exerted, that the people are acting in a way that suggest that somebody else is calling the shots. Am I overstating that?
You know, the majority of the time when it fits the profile and you go out and you interview the people, the reporters and things get stories like, you know, I don't really remember what happened. It's all kind of blurry to me. I'm not sure when I got lost or if I got lost. A couple of times people have stated that they've seen things in the woods that, you know, strange, like people looking at them from behind bushes and things like that. There's some really strange responses when you get down to the minutiae. And like I said earlier, a lot of times the press will report one thing and the facts are another. And every once in a while, a reporter will go out and actually print the truth about what happened. So it's very strange.
I mean, some of these cases, it's like they walk into another reality. You know, and then later their clothes are returned, or sometimes the bodies are returned, but they just go somewhere else, or they're taken somewhere else.
Well, and for some reason, many times they can't recollect exactly what did happen.
Yeah. First time caller, Daniel, who is calling from the Great Lakes area. Hi, Daniel. Welcome to Coast to Coast.
Hello, George. Thanks for taking my call. David, also. I really appreciate it. I'll be quick so I don't keep the guests. I'm shooken right now. I'll tell you, I work for a business that's government contract, and it's really highly classified stuff going on here. And I take breaks at the specific spot, and I don't anymore. And when you told the story, I mean, I automatically thought the Predator. I was sitting there, and I saw the exact same thing what you were talking about. And it seemed blurry. It seemed like the Predator. And I'm thinking, you know, could it be? This is my question. Do you think that it could be either? Are you familiar with the white hats and the black hats, aliens?
I don't know. I'm not. No, I don't know what you mean. White hats,
okay,
black
sorry.
Hats.
They're either friendly or unfriendly, and the black hats are the unfriendlies. Do you think that possibly what I saw, or I think I saw, I have to see it twice to even believe it, because I'm even afraid to tell people. You guys are the first people I've told, because I don't want to sound crazy, but do you think that what I saw could be getting close to this building or entering the building. This building is basically the size of a small town, and a lot of really classified stuff goes on here. Do you think that they could be getting close to there or entering the building to try to see what's going on, try to get intelligence, or what's your take on that?
George, that's probably your answer.
Well, I mean, you know, he doesn't have many of the details, neither do I, about what you saw or where it is. So, you know, we had a guest on a couple of months ago who wrote a book called Camellio, who suggested that we have already developed, our government has developed some sort of a camouflage technology that allows people to be essentially invisible. So, you know, the idea that somebody would use that to enter a classified location where sensitive information is stored, that's entirely possible. But we might be talking about two different things. If humans and spy agencies are developing this technology, they might have got the idea from somebody else. The kind of thing that Dave is talking about has been going on for a very long time over a very broad area out in the middle of nowhere. So you know what, Daniel, if you want, you can leave your name and contact information with our screener, Donna. And perhaps Dave would like to talk to you a little bit further. But we just don't have enough information, I think. I don't want to put Dave on the spot, but don't really have enough information to make a guess about it. I do appreciate you calling and sharing that story with us. We're going to go east of the Rockies, Bobby in Boston. Hi, Bobby. Good morning. Hello. Bobby's gone. How about Nat in Dayton, Ohio on the wild card line? Hi, Nat. Is Nat there in Dayton? Hello. Are you on the air? You there? All right. Going to go east of the Rockies now and try Juan in Atlanta, Georgia. Hello, Juan.
Hi, George.
Howdy.
Good luck to your West Georgia Wolves in the upcoming football season.
Oh, good.
Okay.
What's on your mind?
Okay. I want to ask Mr. Politis a question. Have you looked into the 1,000 to 3,000 cases of missing or murdered First Nation women and young ladies up in Canada? That's become a little bit of a scandal up there because they've been ignored by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and local police up there.
Yeah, the Highway of Tears case.
Yes, I think that's part of it. I think it goes even more expansive than that.
The problem, the issue with that is, first of all, they have a task force of almost 100 police officers working that case, and all indications are it's a serial killer working that highway. I've heard some stories from some people up there that they have some pretty good leads on that, and they're being very cautious about the execution and how they're handling it, but I have no doubt that sometime in the future they're going to arrest somebody or two people for those cases. Talking about the Highway of Tears. Now, the First Nations issue and same with Native American tribal issues, there's a huge problem there with drug abuse, alcohol abuse, and reporting. And sometimes it's very difficult to weave your way through facts and fiction and find out exactly what is going on there. But they do have major issues there.
Thanks for the call. We're going to try Jason in Missouri. Good morning, Jason. You're on with Dave Politis.
Hi, good morning, George. Good morning, David. I called and talked to David about a year ago on George Norrie's show. But I forgot to tell, I don't know if David remembers or not, I had the same experience that David had in the woods where I was about, I'd gotten lost, I was deer hunting, and I got like 10 miles deep in the woods. And I was in Ironton, Missouri, and the woods are really thick back there. And the woods went dead, just like David had reported what would happen to him. And I felt something watching me. And the best way I can describe it is like if anybody's ever been through a tornado, you know that drop in the temperature that you feel? That's what it felt like. And I started walking. As I was walking, I sense something was watching me, like it was walking, mimicking my steps. So I thought, well, I'll take a step and act like I'm going to step through and see if whatever's following me takes a step. And I didn't step down, and I heard the crunch. And I turned around, and nothing was there. Anyway, what I seen in the woods that night was, it was really crazy. It was, I seen some garden gnomes, some concrete garden gnomes 10 miles out in the woods, and I was wanting to see if David had ever seen any strange occurrences at a scene like that.
Nope, never.
It was really, I know that sounds crazy. These garden gnomes were 10 miles out in the woods, and it was, I know this sounds completely crazy, but, you know, I remember I sat down with my back up against a tree, up against a big tree, because I was just, you know, it really had me scared. You know, I had that feeling like, I don't know, like something wanted to hurt me. And I waited out probably for about 10 or 15 minutes, and then the force come back to life, animals start going around again. And then I made a dart as fast as I could up the mountain, and I was listening for a highway, and I got out of there. But, it was really crazy.
Jason, you should probably write to David, email him. We got the links on our website. I think he'd probably like to hear more about it. Thanks for sharing your story with us. Going to try to talk to Thomas in La Jolla. Hi, Thomas.
Thank you, George, for taking my call. And David Politis, you do great research. My question for you, Mr. Politis, is have you ever spoken to Native American tribal elders or tribal shamans or even Native American trackers who participate in the search for missing people in the wilderness? It seems like the Native Americans would have very interesting things to say about disappearances in the wilderness.
Yes to all of it, except the guys that actually do the tracking. Those people are harder and harder to find every year. And 50 years ago, they were pretty predominant. Now they're hard to find. But I've spent a lot of time talking to elders and living in a tribal environment for many years. So, yeah, I have.
Said anything interesting?
Well, nothing more interesting than what I've documented so far. Same sort of things, just a different location.
Dave, do they have disappearances? Do they have tribal traditions where these kinds of things happen to them, vanishings that go way back?
There was a story that Harvey Pratt told me. Harvey Pratt's a Native American chief and he's an agent for Oklahoma Bureau of Investigation, but he told me that when he was a small kid, they used to sit around a campfire and said, no, you don't leave the light of the campfire at night. And he said there was always an overarching statement that, you know, there are bad people out there. And he goes, we'd be in the middle of nowhere and said, hey, don't leave the light of the campfire. And he said, you know, now with what I know today, it seems like there was some other underlying reason that they emphasized that over and over.
We'll try Gordon in Florida. Good morning, Gordon.
George, David, thank you for taking my call. With regard to what you said earlier, there were 5 days that you say elapsed between the time that he could have started walking and they started looking for him. And I know that it was cold weather, but it wasn't as cold earlier on. And I believe I could have walked 15 miles if I'd been young, healthy, had a lot of clothing on, and just really tried. And I wanted to get your thoughts on that. Now, I'm not saying that was definitely possible, but I think it was possible.
With no shoes?
With no shoes? Well, I mean, yeah. Zola Budd, who is an Olympic runner, is a distance runner, and she runs barefoot. And she almost beat Mary Decker Tabb before she got tripped up. And she runs barefoot. Now, granted, she doesn't run in the cold, but you see where I'm going with this, that it's possible he could have gotten a long distance before the weather got really cold. But I'm not saying he could have. I just say that I think he could. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Thanks, Gordon.
Sure.
Well, I think it's contrary to what Search and Rescue thought. It's contrary to what the sheriff thought. It's contrary kind of to what we've talked about tonight. I mean, of course there's people out there that have gotten their feet acclimated to the outdoors and could do things on their feet that people that wear shoes all the time couldn't. And there was never any note that he was someone that didn't wear shoes. And from all the indications from Search and Rescue and the incident archives that I found, it was everyone's opinion that he had to have started when it started to snow, and he didn't leave earlier. Now, I mean, could be wrong about that, but that's what I read into what they stated.
Because I guess, again, 15 aerial miles is not the same as 15 miles walking on the ground.
Oh, for sure.
West of the Rockies, Eric in Long Beach. Hi, Eric.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
All right.
What you guys are describing tonight, especially the woman saying she's seen something that looked like it was wrapped in saran wrap, that's something that I've seen in the urban city back in the early 90s. And I was sitting in a car with an older friend of mine, and I looked up, and I looked at a tree, and it looked distorted, you know, in the tree, and my friend was looking at it too. And I told my friend, I said, are you seeing what I'm seeing? And he said, I'm looking at the one on the left. And then I realized there was two of them. And when they focused their vision on us, they had the most bloodshot, red, glowing type eyes. But one thing I noticed is they noticed us, and it's almost like I can understand what they were saying to each other, and they were in amazement that we were actually able to see them. So long story short, we darted out of there as fast as we could. I mean, it was just, you know, our reaction. We were scared, you know, out of our mind. But I talked to somebody a couple years later, an older guy in the neighborhood, about it, and he said, oh, you guys seen the tree people? So a lot of people for years have been seeing those people around here. They don't have no shape to them, and usually people have seen them, people in the neighborhood would disappear around that time, is when, you know, those things would show up in the neighborhood. And
Eric, we're about out of time. I'm going to let Dave respond, but maybe you should also write to him at the links we have. Dave, a reaction to that?
Sounds interesting. I really don't have any other response.
Maybe that's your next book project, is The Tree People.
Yeah.
Thanks for hanging with us tonight, David, and I recommend that people check out this book. The Bruce Maccabee story alone is worth digging into and seeing that photo. It's a good work again, and I think it feels like you're inching closer to some answers, if that's even possible. Are you still encouraged that it is a solvable mystery?
Boy, that's a million-dollar question, George. I don't know. I mean, there's so many different twists and turns to this road, it's hard to say.
Well, I hope people will check out this book. If you haven't read the earlier ones, check those out as well. We've got the links on our website, thanks to our callers there. In a moment, Ben Politis has been working with David on the movie version of Missing 411. Will be joining us to talk about where the film stands and how the production is going. And a lot of the folks who are listening tonight likely contributed to the production of that movie. So we'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM.